And thank you for being patient through our little ceremonial performance here. And this charming implement came out of Jim and Karen's backyard a few hours ago. So.
Well done.
It actually functions quite well. Ironically, we have a beautiful lady gazing upon us, and the irony is that the point of, you might say, perfect wisdom is the whole universe disappears. Oh, okay. I was saying that the point of perfect wisdom is that the whole universe vanishes. That being so, what's with all of this stuff? Well, fact of the matter is, the whole universe has already vanished, and all of us along with it. So that's why this is okay. We can get away with this. So the perfect wisdom teachings are such that sometimes people hear them and they get irritated. So for instance, I just said that the whole universe, including all of us, has vanished. And I wonder if any of you would confess to being irritated. Nobody, really?
Confused?
Confused is okay, sure, okay. Sure. But actually, sometimes people get angry, especially if you're a hate type like I am. It's like, I don't actually remember my reaction to the teachings of perfect wisdom that I first came across, although that would have been the Diamond Sutra, which I encountered in Edward Kahn's translation in high school. And I remember, it's a slim little volume called Buddhist Wisdom Books. It's an ancient, ancient book now. And I remember reading this sutra, which is not very long, over and over again, and trying to wrap my mind around it. And I think I've told this before, but this was in high school, and finally one of my friends came up to me and said, "What is the matter with you?" I said, "I don't know, what do you mean?" He said, "You've been like totally unreachable for days." I'm like, "Oh, I have?" And I didn't know it, but I was actually meditating on this sutra and trying to, you know, find a way into it. And I didn't know, but at the time, it was finding a way into me. And right around that same time, I started sitting zazen. And that was the sutra coming out again. Into this universe, which convincingly looks like it exists. You know, we have to admit that. But as a matter of fact, the closer you look, the more it disappears. And not only is this true from the, you might say, philosophical, analytical side, but now the side where our enhanced sensorium is peering very, very deeply into reality, reality is slipping away. I don't know if we are yet beyond the level of, what's it called? Quantum foam. But quantum foam is practically nothing. Right? So it's like, what is this place we're living in? Well, perfect wisdom says, well, actually, it's kind of nothing. And the reason it looks like something is because our view is a bit confused. We think things actually exist independently of us. And we independently exist apart from all that stuff out there. So, would someone like to confess to actually believing that that's so? Come on now. Somebody out there thinks everything really exists. Yes? Good. Thank you. Thank you. I suspect there's more than one of you.
Yeah.
Yes?
But just because it doesn't exist separately doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
No, there is what's called conventional existence. But the issue there is conventional existence means everything that we think exists depends on something else. And it does so so perfectly that this illusion of a concrete and separate reality seems quite durable until you really start to look at it. And one way that people do that is they sit still. And they observe phenomena. When you're cultivating sitting practice, one of the easiest, well, I guess, collections of phenomena to observe is this body-mind. And if we follow Buddha's instruction, one of the things you can do is you can look for whatever it is you think is here that is permanent and is entirely yours, is separate from the rest of the universe, and doesn't change. Now, there were lots of people in Buddha's day who actually thought that was more or less how things worked. There was something called the Atman, and it was not separate from a greater reality called Brahman, but it was, you know, a thing. And so what did Buddha do? Buddha went looking for it. And after some years of search, realized it wasn't there. And he said, you know, look as hard as you want and as long as you want, and all you will see is a symphony of, well, he called them, you know, five different factors. And most of you are probably familiar with those, right? Yes. The so-called skandhas, Sanskrit word meaning a heap, a pile of stuff. And they are, the skandhas? Number one?
We just chanted for them.
Huh?
We just chanted them.
We just chanted them. Okay, good. So one is
form.
The that which has extension in space or form. So that's one thing, seems to be there. And then the next one? Is?
Perception.
No, we skipped over one.
Sensation.
So, anytime you sense something, right, a breeze passing by, or a hiccup, or a passing automobile, there is an associated sensation. Right? There's a feeling in the body, usually classified as either kind of nice or kind of not nice or neither. Right? That's another category, sensation. Then there is
perception
or conception, that is recognizing objects out there or in here.
And the sensation, although not cognized and preceding perception.
Not necessarily preceding. Even though, yeah, there's like one through five, but they're not necessarily sequential. In fact, they're more like simultaneous. So then we encounter objects of one kind or another, internal, external, and recognizing them is what Buddha called conception. for perception. And then next, I know this is basic Buddhism, folks, but I have to talk about something. So, what comes next? No. And what does that mean? That's an interesting
mental,
catch-all.
Mental constructions.
Yeah, but in particular, the vector or direction of our consciousness towards some things, away from other things. Right? Attraction and repulsion.
Karmic?
Yes. Yes.
What did you say?
The Sanskrit word is karmic. Oh. So this is karmic consciousness, which is drawn to some things and repelled by others. This dynamic is constantly happening in this body-mind. And then last but not least, the sphere of awareness. And Buddha said, as you all know, go ahead and look. You will not find anything aside from that. So the self, where is that? No matter how hard you look, says he, you will not find one. And the entirety of the universe exists in this mutually interacting and mutually supportive symphony of phenomena, all of which lean on other phenomena. This is what's called what? The big E. Yes? But dependent co-arising is another name for
emptiness.
The absence of inherent existence. So the irony is, this lovely lady is about teaching us the absence of inherent existence. This means goodbye, everybody. It's been nice knowing you. And, you know, that might creep you out, I understand. Feel creeped out by that, but it's also the door to freedom. The teaching, the understanding that there, in fact, isn't anything you can cling to is liberation. And the more you, as they say, realize that, the more that comes to be true in your own experience, the more your own searching has revealed there's nothing there to hang on to. The more your own life will reveal itself to be free in its deepest nature. So to live in according with those teachings is, well, it's kind of challenging. So I read that Diamond Sutra over and over and over again, returning to that teaching over and over again. Thought I figured it out, and turned out no, I hadn't. And of course, our sitting practice is in perfect accord with the true nature of things, both ourselves and the so-called external world. And therefore, it is an ongoing instruction in the true truth of the universe. So how does that sound? There's some ambivalence out there. So we are very fortunate to have her, or in this case, her. Yes, did you have a question?
So I was just thinking, I mean, you said it's very challenging to live that way, but if you're free, wouldn't it be easier to live that way?
Yeah, once you are in fact free, it's very easy. But, you know, let's face it, life is a little sticky. And the habit we have of assuming a permanent entity and a stable external universe, that habit is very ancient and deeply ingrained. So, you know, just kind of waving it aside is probably not going to work. One of these five factors, the samskara, is the manifesting of ancient karma. Right? And this karma of misknowledge, as Robert Thurman calls it, misknowledge, wrong knowledge, can resist being uprooted. So the best thing is to subject misknowledge to a slow, steady drip of, you might say, the solvent of perfect wisdom. Right? And that's what you're doing when you are sitting zazen. You may not hear it going drip, drip. It's probably better if you don't. If you do, you should talk to your teacher. And little by little, something shifts.
Slow is an understatement.
Hmm?
Slow is an understatement.
Slow, yes.
Very slow.
Yes, as Mr. Butler Yeats says, peace comes dropping slow. And he's right. Mm-hmm. But it does. And, you know, I'm sure you all know that already, on some level. Even if you think, oh, I'm just a beginner, you know, I haven't been practicing very long, and I have a long and weary road ahead of me. It's like, you know what, never mind that stuff. Our favorite teacher, Dogen Zenji, reminds us that, you know, the rankest beginner who sits manifests true nature completely. When I first heard that, I had a little trouble with it, so, well, maybe you will. But I also found that very encouraging. And if you really let that be so, your practice is the equal of any.
Can you say that quote again?
He actually said, the zazen, the sitting practice of the rankest beginner, completely manifests true nature. And he wasn't kidding. So, you know, if he says that, then, of course, one inclination is you kind of look for it. Like, all right, he says true nature here somewhere. I'm sitting zazen and I'm waiting for, you know, the eclipse or something to happen, and like nothing much does. So you think, oh, nothing's happening. When in fact, everything's happening. Yes?
That would seem to imply that my true nature is nothing but illusion.
Let's see.
Not nothing, but there's a good dose of it.
Yeah, but what did she say? About delusion?
Your true nature is nothing but delusion.
Yes, and then she elaborates a little bit and says, what does she say about samsara? And what does she say about phenomenal existence and nirvana? What does she say?
Empty.
Oh, somebody.
They're empty.
Hmm?
They're empty.
Yes, which means they're what? Inseparable. Okay,
cool.
The realm or the world of phenomenal existence and the world of vast emptiness are not two things. Okay. So, no escape. Sorry. That's where we are. And the more that teaching informs our life, the more our life is a beacon. A help to other beings, whether we know it or not. In fact, as we say, it's better we don't saddle ourselves with the notion that we're going to be helpful to others. Like, that really gets messed up sometimes. So better, don't mind that. Just be yourself. Study the teachings. practice in stillness, and the way that you will be helping other beings will pervade all existence in a way that you cannot grasp. So, in a way, this lovely lady's her teaching is to put herself out of a job, basically. She's not there anymore. We're not there anymore. Everybody's free. Pretty radical stuff. And, of course, as Buddha also said, well, you know, don't just take my word for it. Go have a look. See what you see. Try to find a self. And, as I love to say, if you do find one and can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you have found one, my teacher will give you $10,000. He has promised. So far, no takers. So, I wouldn't hold your breath, but you know, have a look. Is there actually someone there who exists from its own side, as the Tibetans like to say? Is there someone who exists from her, his, or their own side, entirely independently of everything else? No, there isn't. No such thing has ever been found. So, the Perfect Wisdom teachings are actually pretty extensive. There are many, many, many texts. They go all the way from perfection of wisdom in one syllable, which is ah, all the way in the other direction to the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 verses. It's basically the same as the first one. And, of course, you're welcome to study those teachings. And let them enter you. Right? Don't try to master them. Let them enter. Yes?
Back to the thing about, you know, does a self exist? What if instead of using the word self, you use the word of a form, a body?
Okay. Well, there's a body, but the question is, does the body exist independently? Like, nope. It does not. Nor does any other aspect of this exist independently. So, that's why Buddha said, all there is what he called dependent co-arising. And he said, if you see that, you see Buddha. And if you see Buddha, you see dependent co-arising.
So what you're saying is the body may be there, the physical.
Sure.
It may be there.
Yes. That's heap number one.
But it's
form.
Interdependent. So
absolutely.
You're looking at that one particular object to say that it's an object as opposed to realizing its interdependence. By saying it's an object, you're saying there's it's independent.
Well, that tends to be how people talk, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the conventional view. And the conventional view, unfortunately, is inextricably tied up with what?
Dukkha.
Yes. Misery, basically. Unfortunately, that seems to be true. Right? To the degree that we believe and act as though the universe were composed of individual, independent entities, there is misery for us and for others. So, the Perfect Wisdom teachings are a tremendous antidote to that. They definitely challenge the intellect, The Diamond Sutra is full of apparently ridiculously contradictory language. Full of these juxtapositions. For instance, one of many examples, Buddha is talking about the harmonies of Buddha fields, you know, these Buddha lands where everything is just really delightful all the time. He says, the harmonies of Buddha fields, the harmonies of Buddha fields, as no harmonies they have been taught by Buddha. Therefore, we call them the harmonies of Buddha fields. Oh yeah, that makes sense. Sure. So that weird little perfect wisdom syllogism occurs throughout that sutra, over and over and over again. It's this, it's this, it's not that. Therefore, we call it that. Imagine a poor high school kid trying to, like, wait, what? What? What was that again? Until his friends say, is there something wrong with you? Yes?
It sounds like political speech. It is what it is. You call it
political. Yeah, well, except that the purpose of this political speech is to free people rather than tie them to something. So it has that going for it. Yes?
Is there like a collective karma? I mean, because I have my own karma, I think, for if I were to believe in it, you know, from the stuff I've done. But
yeah,
then we're all, no barriers between us. There's this collective karma.
Well, this question of collective karma has bedeviled Buddhists for a few millennia now. Personally, I don't find that a very compelling question myself. People say, do countries have a karma? It's like, I don't know. Maybe, I guess. Karma is most useful as an aspect of our human experience, namely, when we engage our willpower based on wrong view, karma is generated. There will be a kickback, if you like. And Buddha said, once that started, sooner or later, it must come to fruition, though it be millennia in the future. You do not outrun karma. The good news is, when we are sitting in Zazen, according to how we've been taught, you are not generating karma. Why? Because sitting is actually based in right view. So that's kind of cool. So if you sit every day, you've got at least a period of time there where you're not generating any more karma. That's kind of cool. Now, this whole karma thing is, you know, it's usually tied up with discussions about rebirth. And lately, it seems to me like there are some folks who would like to offer a form of Buddhism or Buddha Dharma where rebirth is kind of not in the picture for some reason. I'm not sure why. I think rebirth is as compelling a story about us as any other, I've heard. So I don't have any problem with that. But some folks don't like it, so they kind of leave it out. And usually when you leave that out, you start leaving out other stuff. And then once you've left out pretty much all of Buddha's teaching, what you have left is something called mindfulness. And then if you're really lucky, you can get people to pay you to tell them about it. Mindfulness. Never mind all that Buddhism stuff. This is just mindfulness. Okay. But it kind of misses the point. Because the whole point of Buddha's teaching was freedom. And if you just ignore all that other stuff, that's not going to be a balanced and compelling picture. it's just going to be another thing you do, like going to the gym. Like, now I shall be mindful. 20 minutes. Then I shall go have a latte. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's worse things you could do, but there's actually more to it than that.
Some people just saw you having a latte in China, so you better be careful.
Yes, yes, yes. And I not so long ago, I had a green tea frappuccino, so I'm, you know, I'm in trouble. And I actually enjoyed it. But,
an empty pleasure.
And it was a rather empty pleasure, but that's okay. You know, any such phenomenal occurrence is an occasion for studying right view, manifesting right view, having a look in whatever's going on for permanent, unchanging phenomena that exist from their own side. And it's kind of cool that you will never find that. And if you think you do, if you think you've found that, you should go and talk to somebody, preferably a Buddhist. And they will help you look at that a little closer until it escapes your grasp. And you're free again. So, that doesn't mean that there isn't a world to take care of, or that there aren't other beings who, you know, they're on their way to being free, but in the meantime, they're having some trouble. So, we should help. And if we can help, as we manifest in our own body-mind, right view, that'll be really helpful to them. But it's not exactly under our control. So best thing is to study and practice in such a way that the teaching comes inside. And then as you act in the conventional world, teaching comes out again in a way that, again, there's no exact script for that. It just happens. And it will make helping others a kind of, how shall I say, a natural thing rather than something you gotta, you know, go to school and get degrees to figure out how that's done. You don't need to do that. All you need is a little dash of right view. It makes a huge difference. So since you're on that path already, I would encourage you to continue indefinitely. And yourself there will be there to help whenever you need it. Are you unwell, brother? Are you unwell?
No.
Oh, good. Yes.
So I'm not sure whether I have a question or not, but I have an idea, a theory, hypothesis that the conviction that I'm the center of the universe and everything else is not arose, not me personally, but as a general proposition, arose about the time that cell walls became fashionable, 2 billion years ago or so.
Oh, yes.
Because there was then an inside and an outside. Mm-hmm. And the inside had a preference to continue its life.
Okay.
And so there's been about 2 billion years worth of schooling and reinforcement of this idea.
Okay.
Because any creatures that didn't have that idea probably didn't hang around so long.
Any creatures didn't have that idea? Yeah, well, if they didn't have that idea, then they were liberated anyway, so why would they want to hang around? So that's okay.
To help others.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's pretty
good.
One
reason.
One other path, of course, is sometimes people who... are illuminated by the dawning of right view, they just can't hang around anymore. They just go.
It may not be necessary. But
there is a bodhisattva vow.
But before there were such people,
yes,
or any people,
yes,
it was still about 2 billion years worth of history.
We think.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So, and that theory, mm-hmm, that I've expounded, seems to make sense in terms of evolution, and in terms of the reality of how all the creatures I'm familiar with, especially the ones that I'm most familiar with, have this deep,
right,
predisposition.
They're convinced that they exist from their own side.
Exactly.
Or at least they act that way. However, human beings have the opportunity to examine that conventional view and dissolve it.
That's what blows me away.
Mm-hmm.
I'm flabbergasted that nature, or whatever, has provided this capacity, this capability, this possibility,
mm-hmm,
which doesn't seem to have any biological survival value per se.
No, probably not. You do know that there are, you know, we are more or less in one of six realms, and we are in the only realm where liberation is actually possible. So the animal realm and the others, forget it. Yeah. You need human birth, right, in order to encounter Buddha Dharma and to practice Buddha Dharma and to plant and cultivate the seeds of liberation for yourself and others. That only happens in our realm. So maybe some of these unicellular organisms, well, they're not exactly in the human realm yet. Right? And there are lots of animals and so forth running around out there, and they're not exactly in the human realm yet. Maybe they will be. I don't exactly know how that works, but perhaps they're on an evolutionary path, if you like, where one day they will achieve human birth. They will hear Buddha Dharma, and the path of freedom will open for them. But if you're in, you know the story, if you're in heaven, so-called, if you're in the heaven realm, right, things are too great, you will not want to hear anything about Buddhism. Right? You're having too great a time.
The jealous gods?
No, this is heaven.
Okay.
Heaven realm. Okay. The warring deities, all they do is fight. That's all they do. All day long, all night long, all they do is fight. Right? So no Buddha Dharma in there either.
Like Congress?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's one example. So that's kind of a pathetic situation. Yeah. Now, of course, the hell realms are no fun, right? All you do there is suffer and be angry. That's it. Right? So again, no real openings there. Hungry ghosts, they just wander around trying to find something to eat or drink, and they can't. That's all they do. All day, all night, they're hungry and thirsty. And again, no opportunities there. So the good news is that at least if you're in one of these other realms, you are combusting obscuring karma that prevents you from being born in the human realm, where you will have the opportunity to hear and practice Dharma. Right? That's the good side. So if you wind up in hell, don't worry too much. It's like this will end too, and you will bounce back. And, you know, find yourself in Sacramento, and you'll be able to come and sit with Valley Streams, and the path of liberation will be accessible to you again. So, you know, that's one story about the universe. And, of course, people say it's quaint. But, again, it works as well for me as most others. And The more and more refined the so-called scientific view of our world becomes, the less and less there is there to look at. The more and more whatever's there eludes our grasp. Nobody's ever seen quantum foam. Right? It's a supposedly a mathematical certainty. That's it. Nobody's ever seen it. And yet, according to pretty rigorous science, it has to be there. But what is it? It's nothing. It's just stuff bubbling up and passing away, bubbling up and passing away. That's what Buddha said. That's what this life is. Stuff bubbling up and passing away, and that includes us. Kind of neat, actually. So, the other thing about perfect wisdom teaching is sometimes it kind of makes people feel kind of sick. So maybe I should shut up now. Stop. You know, let her just radiate for us. You know, engulf us in her warm radiance. And I should stop talking about this stuff in case people are getting upset.
Well, it is kind of daunting.
Daunting?
Mm-hmm. To open to a universe in which nothing is graspable, mm-hmm. including one's own being.
Yeah.
It has the smack of dying about it.
Yeah.
Something dying.
Yeah. So that's one phase. The other phase is liberation. And that's why we have, you know, these. Do you have any wrathful deities up on the walls, or did you get rid of them?
We bring them out in October.
Oh, okay. Yes, yeah, so these are all peaceful manifestations. That they all have another side, which is like really, you know, teeth and blood and severed heads and stuff.
There's one grasping onto the wheels of life.
Oh yeah. I think that's usually thought to be Yama, the Lord of Death, who is turning the wheel of samsara. The hub of which, of course, we know is what?
Greed, anger, and greed, hate, and delusion.
That's right. Greed, hatred, and confusion. That's the hub of the wheel. And Yama, the Lord of Death, is turning it round and round and round. But there are lots of other manifestations of these deities that are really frightful looking. And that's what you're talking about. But the same deity has this magnificent, peaceful manifestation when you realize. Oh, yeah. Daunting is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is completely free, completely open. Right? No walls. What does Dylan say? There are no
fences
facing. Exactly. Good old Dylan Roshi. So, enough? Probably too much. What time is it? Oh, God, it's almost 9 o'clock. I'm exhausted. Yes?
Well, I mean, it's not like we can sit back on our laurels and be free.
Well, if we really could do that, it'd be all right. But it's a little tricky.
Right.
You know, this karmic thing keeps happening, and wrong view is so seductive and habitual.
Thinking you've got it.
Thinking you've got it will really trip you up. Right. So we keep going back to our practice, back and back and back. And as we do that, the solvent does its work. Someday you will be free, whether you like it or not. Well, that probably is enough. And thank you all for a fun evening of practice. And you have a new beneficent deity to gaze upon you as you practice. Pretty nice.
Thank you for opening her
eyes. Yes, her eyes are actually our eyes. So that was easy. Thank you very much.